You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 1st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sarah Jaffe, independent journalist, Nation Institute Fellow, on her book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Also on the program today, he's back. Bannon Trump's Conway for Trump's teleprompter. I wanted to do a variety style headline for that one. And it's Jimmy Reefer Cake's world, ladies and gentlemen. Daily pot use has doubled in the past 12 years. The New York Times blows it big time on Donald Trump's speech. Are you really, if you're going to file it before the speech actually takes place, are you really going to bet on him being reasonable? Is that the bet you're going to make? Then you lose. Also, Obama announces a raise for federal workers and appoints an enemy of public pensions to oversee Puerto Rico's dealing with their public pensions. Wonder how that's going to work out. Texas police data released 656 shootings, 71% of those of unarmed individuals. Nearly half of those unarmed were black. And Tim Cook, very, very upset that his company owes $14.5 billion in back taxes. Seems to be really bothering him. And revealed Trump's two new leaders of his campaign, members of the Council of National Policy, an ultra-secretive conservative group. I think it was at one point labeled a hate group. It's that guy Corsi. And the guys from WorldNet Daily. I mean, it's a lunacy. I don't know. Are we surprised by that at all? I'm not.
When you say top secret, do you mean institutionalized?
Institutionalized top secret?
I'm saying like they're meeting literally in an institution.
I think it is. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what you're saying. All right, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if you watched. Yesterday was just, it was just insane. Donald Trump comes back from Mexico. There's a lot of theories that are going on out there, right? Like, I mean, he was very subdued in Mexico. Claimed that they did not discuss the wall, which is, it's not only the central focus of Donald Trump's policy with Mexico. It is the central focus of Donald Trump's raison d'etre. And he was very low-key in Mexico. And then he gets to Arizona, and he takes off like a rocket. Now, here's my theory. I'm just throwing this out there. Xanax in the morning, meth at night. I don't know. Is that possible?
Diet pills throughout.
Right. You got to maintain, and then you got to drive yourself down for the
you don't want to hush the mellow, but you don't want to peak too early. You got to calibrate.
Here is the part about the speech last night that I feel like no one is pointing out. He's on teleprompter. Now, 3 weeks ago when he gave his first or the series of teleprompter speech, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, this was the big turnaround, right? Kellyanne Conway had come in, put him on teleprompter. He was no longer going to be this loose cannon. He's no longer going to go rogue. They're not letting Trump be Trump. They're letting Trump be contained. Last night, they had him on teleprompter, and the speech sounded exactly like any speech he would have given 4 or 5 weeks ago. It's as if the only reason why they put him on teleprompter was so that he could remember where he was with his 9 or 10 point plan. Like, literally, that seems to be the only reason. The guy was screaming at the top of his lungs. It was terrifying. Like, Mila came out to watch it. She's just like, I can't watch this. It was too disturbing for her. And here he is, of course. And this is with all due respect to everybody involved, what a cuck. I mean, Donald Trump goes down to Mexico and meets with Enrique Peña Nieto. And supposedly, Peña Nieto claims that when they first, like, almost like, basically was like, nice to meet you. We're not paying for a wall.
Trump just might as well have been, like, invited the guy to go on a date with Melania. He just totally folded.
Pathetic. Didn't say a word.
Sad.
But he had to come back with this last night, ladies and gentlemen, during his speech to, what's also amazing about it was the audience. Like, you look in there and it was almost, I would say, our YouTube feed has a greater gender disparity than what was it? Like, YouTube is like sort of classically like male. This, I mean, I was like 95% males between the ages of like 21 and 65.
The audiences have always been the most disturbing part.
I would say 75% wearing baseball caps. And I don't know. It's tough to, you know, to guess at these things. But I would say about 98% white. I mean, you know, I'm shooting from the hip here on this. Here is Donald Trump with his signature promise from last night.
Number one, are you ready? Are you ready? We will build a great wall along the southern border. Mexico will pay for the wall. Mm-hmm. 100%. They don't know it yet, but they're going to pay for the wall. And they're great people and great leaders, but they're going to pay for the wall. On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
I got to say, that wall sounds super sexy. And he said, like, it's going to be tall and beautiful and
perhaps
powerful.
If it was not an inanimate object,
shiny.
I would take it out for
greased
a date.
Up.
It's going to be physical.
It's going to be... And then, of course, he said Mexico doesn't realize that they're going to pay for the wall. Like, I don't even think they have the GDP to pay for the wall, frankly. But so there it is, Donald Trump trying to cover up. I mean, that was that comment, and that had to be number one, because that was the rhetorical version of his hairdo, right? Like, it was, he had to cover up the massive bald spot that was, in this instance, his inability when he meets the president of Mexico to even raise the question of paying for the wall.
That wall will be the my daughter of walls.
No. Do you love books but find that you never have time to read them? I know Matt doesn't.
I don't think it's a time question with Matt.
Well, Audible.com has the perfect solution. Get audiobooks and listen to those books you've been meaning to read while on the go. You can do it in the gym, during your commute, when you're supposedly sitting and having dinner with your kids. Just have to be very sort of sly about the headphones. Audible.com has audiobooks from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine, newspaper publishers, business information providers. Their app is free. It works on iPhones, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone. You can also download and listen on your Kindle Fire in over 500 MP3 players. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. So you can access your books anytime right from your smartphone. I got to say, I use this with some regularity with books that we have on the show. I mean, I don't know what it was about Dayan's book, Chain of Title, but I kept going back and forth, and I kept losing the book. And so I would read a chapter of the book, and then I would listen to a chapter, and then I'd find the book again, and I would read it and back and forth. But this I didn't even know. Audible.com also has the Great Listen Guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you choose, no worries. You can exchange the book you aren't happy with another title anytime, no questions asked. Did you know that?
I do this a lot, actually, to the point where I almost feel guilty about it, but I also give Audible a lot of money, so.
I had no idea you could do that.
Yep, it's seamless. They just say, you want to return it? Yep.
Now, you can be like Matt, and what do you do? Have you, like, actually, like, hacked your app so that it can go, like, 15 times speed, or what is it? What do you listen to a book at?
An Audible app can go up to 3 times speed. I usually keep it around 2.5, maybe 3 if it's something I'm more familiar with.
There you go. Don't try that at home, folks. I wouldn't advise normal people for listening to their book at more than 1.5 speed. And just for listeners, Audible.com is offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/majority today to start your free trial. Again, show your support for the Majority Report. Get a free 30-day trial at audible.com/majority. If that was Matt, Matt could theoretically use a, I guess, a dummy email account. You go and you could probably listen to how many books could you listen to at your speed on a 30-day trial?
You could probably get one a day.
Maybe. So you would listen to about 30 books?
I'd probably go for 20 because I go for longer ones with Audible. I like to use my credits with like a 25-hour book as opposed to a 12-hour book. I mean, it's just economics.
Honestly,
you know what we should do is we should honestly have a tutorial.
That we should.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, an interview I recorded just half an hour ago with Sarah Jaffe, author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Sarah Jaffe. She is a Nation Institute fellow, an independent journalist, and author of the newly released Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Sarah, thanks so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you for having me back.
So, Sarah, let's just start with this. We were talking before we started here that you had a lot of trouble selling this book. Give us a sense of why that might be the case.
Yeah, so I had been working on writing a proposal for something that would eventually become this book for years. I started it sort of when Occupy was still a thing, or at least fresh in people's minds. And by the time it was actually worked into something that seemed like it could actually be a real book, it was the summer of 2014, and things were pretty quiet. There was not a whole lot of protest activity going on, and publishers were like, I don't know if this is really a thing, and you're talking about this stuff and that stuff that we don't know if anybody actually cares about. And, you know, we got a lot of no's. And we had the people, the wonderful people who ended up publishing this book, I should give all the credit because they did, you know, have some interest in it. But they were also, you know, they were still like, you know, can you prove this a little bit more? And that was in August of 2014. And we all know what happened in August of 2014. Now, you know, Eric Garner was killed. Eric Garner was killed in July. Michael Brown was killed and protests broke out across the country with, you know, the thing that we're now calling the Movement for Black Lives or Black Lives Matter. And it was a little easier to say, like, you know, hey, maybe I have a point here after all. And right now it's so timely and it's, you know, it's been great. And the publisher now, the publisher has been great the whole way through, really. It's fun to sort of be like, all those people who said no to me.
Well, it's interesting. I'll tell you what I find interesting about it is because your book is, there's almost sort of a form and function quality to this, because as you travel across the country to see these, meet different people involved in these protest movements and social action movements, and you're tracing it both sort of the recent history of it and going back to the earlier radical history in this country. It keeps reminding me, this is completely, I don't know why, but there was a book about travel that I read about 25 years ago when I was in Australia called Songlines. And it was about sort of the Aboriginal, the way that they would they would map things with stories and map temporal and physical space with stories. And in some level, you've done that. And was there one person that you met who explains or it best illustrates sort of the type of era we are in terms of social action?
Oh man, I mean, it's really hard to say just one because there are so many and there are all of these connections between them. One of the people that I follow through a few parts of this book is Nalini Stamp, who I met during Occupy Wall Street and who then went to Florida to be part of the formation of what would become the Dream Defenders, who have now become this group that is really central to the Movement for Black Lives. And, you know, and she is involved in a whole bunch of other work. She moved to Atlanta for a little while, and I actually visited her in Atlanta while I was reporting on Occupy Homes down there. And she was doing work with the Fight for 15 and with safe scheduling for retail workers who, you know, and end up with really, really unreliable schedules and can't figure out things like childcare or just, you know, having a life ahead of time. And so, you know, I watched her move through all of these movements, and she joined me along with a couple of other people from different movements, Mary Clinton and Nastra and Mohi, at my New York Book Launch last week. Mm-hmm. And it was, it's great to once again to hear, you know, what these people think of what's going on right now. And I'm actually caravanning to North Dakota in a couple of weeks with them to visit the pipeline blockade that's going on at Standing Rock in North Dakota. So
what do you think?
Those are certainly people that are still with me.
What do you think? So we have, you know, the sort of, I guess this era marked, I mean, what was the opening salvo, would you say? I mean, in some ways it's, in terms of first, you know, give us the right and the left, because in terms of like where we first saw this energy, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And I think it was really important to talk about the right in this book. And most of the movements that I'm talking about, obviously, are movements from the left, because I think other than the Tea Party, and I guess if we want to call what's going on around Donald Trump a movement, most of these things have been on the left. But the first protests that we saw after the financial crisis in 2008, right, were the Tea Party. It was a right-wing movement. It was people who are self-identified conservatives who were mad about, you know, Obama's policies. They were mad about bank bailouts, which came under George W. Bush. And they were mad that, you know, that the the priorities of the country were skewed. And some of their criticisms I agree with, some of them I don't, right? I think my parents, who are conservatives, my mother just texted me to tell me that my father started reading my book and he agrees with me about the banks. And so, you know, I think that these are points of overlap, even if we don't necessarily agree. And the question is, how do we get to a point where we can actually come up with solutions that we can agree on, and on the fights that are really sort of frightening and impossible to come to consensus on, then the question is, how do we win? And then by doing that, prove that we're right.
It's interesting because it seems to me that on the left, things started later because there was a sense that Obama was going to fix it. Right? Is that your sense?
Yeah, I think that there was a real tendency on at least the sort of center left, or the left that broadly coalesces around the Democratic Party, that, you know, this was going to be a transformative presidency. You know, if you look back at articles in like The Nation and stuff, there were these real big plans being put forward that like Obama could create a Green New Deal, all of this stuff that just didn't happen. One of my obsessions is like whatever happened to high speed rail, because this was supposed to be one of the big things from like the stimulus program, and this was going to be great, and it just hasn't happened at all, and that's been 8 years. But also, you know, the far left, which, you know, we're seeing some of these protests that are coming out now of people who are defiantly outside of the Democratic Party or have given up on it, and that was really historically weak in 2008. So the people who might have had an answer to, like, why is the economy collapsing around our ears were mostly either, you know, they were academics teaching. I love Rick Wolf's story in the book. He's an economist, and he's a Marxist economist who was teaching at UMass Amherst, which is one of the few sort of radical left economics departments in the country. And since the financial crisis, he's just had a total career rebirth, and he's left Amherst and he lives in New York and he travels the country giving lectures. He's written a bunch of books. He's got a radio show now. Mm-hmm. He does monthly talks in New York because people were looking for somebody who could explain why capitalism was crashing around our ears. And so we've watched that shit take shape. And, you know, you see Shama Sawant getting elected as a socialist in Seattle to the city council, and you see Bernie Sanders, who says he's not a capitalist, in a Democratic presidential debate get 12 million votes. There's this huge opening up of space for ideas on the left that just had really been unthinkable for quite a long time before this.
And is there, I mean, what is the relationship between these sort of these milestones, if you will, as time has progressed? I mean, it seems to me there was two elements, and one is that aspect. It was sort of a sense of that Chris Hayes discussed the sort of the failure of the elites and institutions in our society and whatnot, and it combined also with the pain of the 2008 financial crisis and how that pain sort of rippled through society and through time. I mean, starting with Wisconsin, in your travels, was Wisconsin the first sort of a major salvo in what has now been, it seems like, over the past 7-8 years, a series of expansion and, I guess, growth of this sense of protest?
Yeah, I think, you know, I begin the book, the first chapter, with the Republic Windows and Doors workers who occupied their factory in late 2008. And I, you know, there was a sense, I remember like watching that on Rachel Maddow, right? That was a big deal, that everybody, there was this idea that this was going to grow, and it really didn't.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, right, Wisconsin happened, and we were in the middle of this debate about how big and how deep the budget cuts were going to be and whether Social Security was going to get cut, and that whole debt ceiling thing, remember that mess? And, you know, and then suddenly there's this protest in Wisconsin about collective bargaining rights for public sector workers, which is like a sentence that I thought I was one of five people in the country who cared about. And maybe not five, but, you know, other than people who are actually public sector workers at risk of losing their collective bargaining rights, it didn't seem like a thing that was going to spark what it did. And, you know, at max, the protests were estimated to have, like, you know, near 100,000 people. That's huge. And that's not, you know, people from around the country went there, but people from around Wisconsin, more importantly, went there. And there was, you know, farmers driving in on their tractors mm-hmm. to show support. It was really this moment. And I talk about austerity in the book, which is a term that's used some in this country. It's used more in Europe, around the way that, like, state budgets here and, you know, European countries' budgets under the Eurozone have just been slashed in order to supposedly, you know, tighten their belts to get out of the recession. Except the problem with slashing budgets and cutting jobs is that you actually create a deeper recession. You don't make it better because people don't have money and they're not paying taxes and they're not buying things. And so, when we look back at the Wisconsin protest, I see that as the first protest against austerity as well as a protest for union rights.
And so, I mean, how much, in your sense, does that the idea of that protest being in the ether and the occupation of mm-hmm. the state house, yeah. right? I mean, that was a big
right,
feature
yeah.
of that. You had people going in yeah. and just sitting down in the state house, which,
yeah.
You know, I guess I had seen when I was in college, but that was years and years ago. You just didn't mm-hmm. see that often.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even during the Bush years, we never saw
right.
that type of tactic. And right. it
yeah.
seems like that's in the ether from that point going forward.
Yeah, I think that there's one of the things, and the reason that we went with the title Necessary Trouble is because it is this sense that, like, the tactics were not going to be enough, that you couldn't just have a march, right? People marched, millions of people literally marched against the Iraq War, and nobody cared. So you really had to find tactics that were going to be more in your face, that were going to be more disruptive, that were going to demand attention and, you know, make it difficult for the people in power to go along with business as usual, which, like, occupying the Capitol building certainly does that, right? And we've seen this over and over again since then. And, like, in Wisconsin, I think we started to see the shape of the occupations that we've seen going forward and that we're seeing again now with things like Freedom Square in Chicago, where you would have these occupations and they would claim space in something that was supposed to be public space. Sometimes there are public spaces that have been privatized. And they would, you know, camp out there and stay there and protest there, but they would also have things like free libraries, right? Free food for everybody. I remember everybody calling in pizzas for the protesters in Wisconsin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these sort of little model societies that were in explicit sort of rebuke to the things that Walker was going to do, all these budget cuts that, you know, that we were facing under these austerity measures that everybody's facing, and that, you know, that are spaces where people can be political in public together, which is a thing that had been really, you know, getting harder and harder to do in this country.
It's funny because it's as if all the talk on the right about Alinsky, people actually just
yeah.
started to read him. I mean, I think I heard, you know, sort of middle-aged women protesting David Letterman that he was using Alinsky tactics on Sarah Palin before I had ever read Alinsky. And
yeah.
and you start to see that at least that concept of a small amount of people can be very disruptive. Relative
yeah.
to we had hundreds of thousands on the streets of New York City,
right.
and it was just like, avoid the Upper East Side.
Right.
talk a little bit about the notion of intersectionality, particularly when it comes to race and class, because we see that more and more manifested, it seems to me, and maybe. Not so much that it's manifested, but there's a consciousness of it that is
mm-hmm.
Impacting the way that people organize, whether it's environmental groups or what's happening with Moral Mondays.
Yeah.
Talk to that aspect of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, Moral Mondays is fascinating because it really, you know, under the framework of Moral Mondays incorporated all of these things that the right usually tries to paint as explicitly immoral. So abortion rights and gay rights. And now in North Carolina with this really awful anti-trans people bill that tries to restrict whether trans people can go to the bathroom in public, they really, you know, incorporated trans rights. And what they did by saying that all of these things are connected, that these things are connected to the fact that the state government is also trying to restrict voting rights, which, by the way, the Supreme Court just said that they cannot do. That was yesterday. So that is an excellent victory for that movement. And that they were cutting budgets for schools, for Medicaid, at a time when we were supposed to be expanding Medicaid. They were cutting it. To look at this and say the same people are doing all of these things, the same people are backing the people who are making all of these cuts, right? The same few rich donors are donating to all of these politicians, and that our struggles are actually interconnected and they overlap in us, right? So I quote in the book Ivana Gonzalez, who's a wonderful young organizer, and she is the daughter of immigrants. She is herself a U.S. citizen, but she had a cousin who was in immigrant detention at the same time that she took a rest at Moral Monday. And she gave a speech about how, you know, she is a student and her struggles on campus with her programs being cut and her tuition going up were connected to the struggles of workers on campus to get a living wage, which she was organizing with them. And that as an immigrant, her, you know, the relationship that she had with the state cracking down on her as an immigrant was related to the state trying to decide whether or not she could, as a woman, have a safe and legal abortion. And when it came time to explain to her parents why she had been, you know, why she had taken part in this protest and why she had gotten arrested, she used the example of saying that her cousin was in immigrant detention and this is what happens to us in this country and this is why I had to stand up.
It's really fascinating to me. I mean, first off, like were it not for Donald Trump attacking the Khan family, I think Barber's right. speech from that night would have been the one that people had been taught would be talking about extensively, because that was it was an amazing speech. But also, you know, like I have a knee jerk reaction to just the idea of morality being used that way. And maybe it is because it's associated with a pastor. And I get a little bit like that. The tiny hairs on my back stand up just a little bit on that. Yeah. But it's also another way of saying, like, there's a group of people who are immoral, and what they're doing, their whole policy set is immoral. And it's sort of, you get away without saying that and making it sort of more positive. It's a fascinating dynamic. And I wonder, like, is that growing? I mean, because it seems like there was a lot of sort of disparate things. I mean, Occupy, I think, you know, tried to sort of encompass a lot of different things, but it was Occupy Wall Street. I mean, it was focused on something that was financial. And we saw the wildcat strikes with fast food and Walmart. And now it seems to be expanding out. And I feel like sort of part of that also came from the environmental movement. Like, they've been it seems to me that, like, folks like Bill McKibben and organizations that have been consciously trying to broaden their message to make I don't know, to recruit more people or to just make people see the relevance in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the expansion and the changes in the climate movement are really fascinating, right? Like I mentioned this, the pipeline blockade in North Dakota, right, being led by indigenous people. And a group of Black Lives Matter protesters from Toronto actually went down to join them for a few days. And there are people now, you know, planning these trips from all over the country. And I like I said, I'm planning to go myself and cover it. And this is an example of, like, the environmental movement saying, like, this is actually about people. It's not about, like, polar bears and whatever, which, like, polar bears are great, but it's really hard to get people who are having a hard time paying their bills to care about polar bears. But when you are saying, like, this pipeline is going to go through our water, then it becomes a lot more real. Or when you are people in there's this wonderful group that I talk about in the book called Push Buffalo, and they are a community organization in Buffalo, New York, and they started doing a lot of work around, they had been working on housing, and one of the biggest issues that people had with being able to afford housing was also paying their electric and heating bills, right? Their gas and electric bills, because keeping your house warm in Buffalo mm-hmm. in winter is really hard because Buffalo is really, really cold. And so when they're organizing around energy, then they start to think about what does that mean if we actually had clean, renewable energy that the community had control over, rather than these big energy monopolies that charge us whatever they want, and they're using the dirtiest energy possible, and they're paying more, and they want to, you know, frack our communities. This was a big, you know, the fracking fight was huge in New York, and Andrew Cuomo, contrary to what everybody expected him to do, actually, you know, went for a fracking ban because he was pressured very, very hard by activists. And so when you start to see people like, you know, low-income people of color in Buffalo seeing their fight for an affordable energy bill as a climate justice fight and coming down to the People's Climate March and really saying, like, we are the front lines of climate justice, you have a whole different movement than the one that sort of was easily caricatured as, you know, some white people who like to hug trees.
Right. I mean, you had those people from Buffalo marching in the same march with some farmer in Nebraska who's upset about the eminent domain aspects of this.
Right. Yeah. And with the people who are now blockading this pipeline in North Dakota, and people who had been fighting the tar sands fight in the north of Canada, who are also mostly First Nations people up there. And you start to say, like, oh, the climate justice fight is a racial justice fight, because all of this dirty energy gets extracted from the backyards of people who are poor and people who are Black and brown and Native, and they are the ones who have the dirty energy, you know, or the trash dumps and the polluting trucks run through their neighborhoods, and they have, you know, the South Bronx has some of the worst asthma rates in the country. And Michael Johnson, who's an organizer with South Bronx Unite, had this wonderful, you know, we had this wonderful conversation where he was talking about Eric Garner. Again, Eric Garner was killed by a New York police officer who put him in a chokehold. And Eric Garner had asthma. And Eric Garner had asthma because he had grown up near the Gowanus Canal, which is a Superfund site.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so the people in the South Bronx who were fighting the location of yet another truck-driven business in their neighborhood were saying, we can't breathe. Which is the same thing that, you know, the cry that went up after Eric Garner's killing, because Eric Garner's last words were literally, I can't breathe. And so, you know, to connect those again is really powerful.
And from a structural standpoint, I mean, there's been a lot of, I mean, Occupy Wall Street obviously is sort of the most, I guess, prominent example where where people were very conscious of the organizational structure.
Right.
Give me a sense as you you've looked at all these movements across the country. Like, where's the median in terms of what these organizational structures look like, and is there a place where people are satisfied that things are not so top down that they feel excluded, but that are not so horizontal that things can't get done? Because in the wake of in the wake of Occupy, I mean, that was almost like the singular complaint that I heard,
right,
was that the organizational structure drove people away from the movement.
Yeah, and I think that that's been one of the things that people are really struggling with, right? That, like, horizontal structure of Occupy was really appealing to people because who were feeling like they'd been failed by elites, right? To go back to what we were talking about before with elite failure and all of this. If you feel like the government that is elected to represent you is failing you, then maybe you want to do it directly. But, you know, then when you get however many thousand people in a park trying to agree on, you know, whatever minute detail of the day, and you have to come to 100% consensus, that gets really unwieldy really fast. And so, you know, Occupy experimented with some different structures. The Movement for Black Lives groups are experimenting with different structures. And what we're seeing, what I think is really interesting, is that there's all these different groups, right? When you look at the Vision for Black Lives platform that just came out, that was the work of 50 different groups that came together and worked for a year on writing this incredibly detailed, incredibly well-researched, you know, broad policy platform. And those different groups all have, you know, in many cases, slightly different structures. Some have actual directors and leaders and sort of elected positions. Some have staff organizers. Some are purely just, you know, sort of loose organizations. They're all slightly different and they're all experimenting with different structures. And I think that's helpful because different structures are going to work differently for different people. You know, I think it's a small minority of people who came out of Occupy, but there are some people who really are very deeply wedded to consensus process. And, you know, for those people, it may work if they are working with other people who are also very deeply wedded to consensus process. And then you can, as that group interact with other groups and come together to form, you know, a coalition, to create a campaign, to take a particular action, to support other people's actions. And so, you know, I think that that's one of the ways that the structure question is being answered, is like lots of different structures and lots of different experiments, and then people talking to each other about what works and what doesn't work.
Well, I wanted to get you, we were going to do more on this in the coming days, but your sense of that platform, the Black Lives Matter document that came out, I guess, was now two or three weeks ago. What?
August 1st, actually. So.
What is your reaction to it?
I mean, I think it's the best example of an intersectional policy platform that I've seen, right? It's this thing that says, you know, we need universal health care, which is universal health care for everyone in this country. It's not, you know, whatever. It also says we need reparations. We need reparations for mass incarceration, as well as for slavery, as well as for redlining and other, you know, historically racist actions of the state. And then it says, you know, we need to stop funding wars overseas. We need to take the money that we divest from those wars and divest from policing and from, you know, privatized prisons, from all prisons, and invest those back in the communities and have things like free public education, free higher education, free, again, healthcare. And, you know, we're talking about things that are both, you know, that each part of that platform is argued for as a part of a Black liberation struggle, but it's also, these are things that, you know, if this policy platform was enacted, it would create both a radically different, and for most people, unless you're very, very rich from selling arms to Saudi Arabia or whatever, a better world. And I think that that's, you know, it's a fascinating document. It took a ton of work and it's so well researched that, you know, we'd have to talk about it for 3 weeks. And I'm, like you said, it sounds like you're going to. So,
yeah, I mean,
I think there's a lot to engage with in there.
And lastly, the one of those moments over the past, I guess, 6-7 years that really stuck out for me was the Chicago teachers strike, because this was sort of the best example of social action unionism, I think, that we've seen.
Yeah.
Speak to that, and to, you know, I had a sense a couple of years ago that was going to catch on a little bit more, and but I haven't quite seen it. But I'm not convinced that I could see it from where I sit.
One of the things that happened because it caught on is that there have been a lot of almost strikes among teachers, and so I reported on a few. There were a few I was following, like a couple of years ago in Portland, and Seattle and St. Paul, in a bunch of different places, where the teachers had really taken a page from the Chicago teachers' book, and the elected officials looked at what happened in Chicago and said, nope, we'll give you what you want. Mm. And so when you look at the Seattle teachers' contract, they got some really interesting stuff in there. And they did have a strike. And so, you know, I think that a lot of what is going on in particularly among teachers unions, although there are other examples like the New York State Nurses Association here that also had a social justice caucus take over and have done really interesting work. I talk about them in my book, about their work around Hurricane Sandy. But I just heard a rumor that they also might be going, somebody from that union might also be going to North Dakota to the pipeline blockade. And so, you know, there's been a resurgence of that.
When nurses, the nurses unions have always been there, it seems to me.
The nurses have been leaders on this front. I think it doesn't surprise me that the care workers are out in front on understanding that issues are intersectional.
But have you seen changes in leadership in like statewide or local teachers unions? Because I mean, I know I had spoken to Barbara Maldaleone from Massachusetts, and I was blown away by. Our talk with her, and I'm wondering if there's more of that going on. Where, and I should just explain just briefly that where the unions perceive themselves as their agenda is not just to help their own union members, but to help the community that they're integrated with and that they serve.
Right, and so what we're seeing is both like these caucuses taking over, and also where they haven't taken over, they're having an influence on policy. So sort of like Bernie Sanders pulling Hillary Clinton to the left, the existence of these reform caucuses is pulling the union leadership to be more proactive, to be more interested in community organizing, and to really see this as a tactic that can work. And so, you know, I look at things like the Verizon strike this year and how, I mean, first of all, how successful they were able to be. I think they surprised everyone, including themselves, with how much they actually won from Verizon in the end. But it took, you know, quite a long strike and a lot of commitment from the workers. But they got a lot of community support. They had people, you know, adopting stores, adopting picket lines. And interestingly, CWA is doing the union that was represented most of the workers in the Verizon strike. CWA is doing political education now within the union. So they've got a political education program that really, you know, talks about things like neoliberalism, the financialization of the economy, what this means for them as workers at places like Verizon. And they're really thinking about these bigger questions that are not just, you know, how do we win a raise in the next contract, but that are like, how do we as working people have more power within this economy?
Interesting. Lastly, the internet. I mean, because it seems to me like there is, like, even though as much as activists are aware of the power of the internet, like, I still feel like we are in an era where we don't quite realize what has changed in terms of holding people to account. I mean, because I'm not convinced that a lot of what, you know, if that Verizon strike takes place 10 years ago, now, of course, all the issues would be different, right, like wireless and whatnot. But if that Verizon strike takes place, you know, even 10 years ago or 12 years ago, just the awareness level of it would have been just much less. And the pressure on Verizon would have been much less.
The Verizon workers went on strike right before Occupy Wall Street happened. And they went back in without a contract. And they really, you know, they felt like that was a defeat. And this time around, they were partly because they had lost, but also partly because things had changed so much since then. You know, they were really able to have a totally different narrative around this strike that allowed them to win.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time. Well, Sarah, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're really busy. I'm glad you are, because the book deserves a lot of success. The book is Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Sarah Jaffe, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Before we head to the fun half, I want to play this video because there's Sarah had talked about the folks in North Dakota who are attempting to block a pipeline. There are protesters getting arrested there, and we have a really cool video of a guy getting arrested who has been who basically chained himself to one of the backhoes on the construction site. And you'll notice there's a cop who's like both trying to handcuff him and give him water simultaneously. So here it is. I mean, people are headed out there And the man who was handcuffed to the backhoe, Dale American Horse Jr. And here it is. There you have it. I mean, the guy had basically, it looks like a cast that he put around.
He made like a sort of pipe cast around the handcuffs that he has inside of the pipe around the backhoe so they can't, so he's tougher to get him out.
I mean, it was nice of that cop to offer him water.
Yeah, there's a good picture of the guy. He actually did drink it at a different part. And from what I've seen, both the police and the protesters have been pretty well behaved up there, so.
So that is just another, you know, a protest indicative of what Sarah Jaffe was saying on the interview today. Folks, a reminder, this program relies on your support for its existence. If you have the financial means to become a member, please do. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day. Pennies a day. And then as a bonus, what we do is we give you an extra, I don't know, supposed to be 40 or 50 minutes, but have we done 50 minute fun half?
Unless there's something specifically that we need to get out of here for.
10 months? I don't even think so. When was the last time we ended the show at 1:30? Never. No, I don't think since you guys have been here.
No, I think there's been one time because I remember because it was interesting.
Oh, Matt, always got to be the contrary. Why don't you tell it to your book on tape?
It's principles.
JoinTheMajorityReport.com, folks. And also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Sarah was talking about in Wisconsin, people sent pizzas to protesters who were occupying the Capitol in Madison. And if you'll recall, longtime members or listeners will recall, I was out there, and I don't think I was live from the protest, because I don't think we had the technology at the time. But I think we still have some videos, and I sent some stuff back, and I did one or two shows from there, and we had a lot of audio. It was pretty close to the final weekend. I'm not sure if it was the final weekend or the one before that, but that was when the farmers had come in on their tractors, because one of the things that that Scott Walker had cut was Wisconsin's version of Medicaid, which gave support to a lot of farmers in terms of their health care. Nevertheless, the point is JustCoffee.coop, which is in Madison, was also one of those entities who were given coffee to the protesters. And a great outfit and great coffee, too. That's the upside. So you get 10% off if you use the coupon code MAJORITY. And you can also try out the Majority Report blend, which makes for a great gift. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com because we get a kickback. So you notice no difference. But if you click on that link and bookmark it and always buy your stuff through there, we get a kickback off of what you buy. It doesn't change anything for you. It's just their, you know, affiliate program. Also, folks, if you watch any YouTube videos at all, go and become a subscriber to our YouTube channel. You can do that, I think, through the app, or you can check it out through the app at the very least. But go and subscribe. It takes a second. It's youtube.com/user/SamSeder. Is that what it is? I don't know. You can click to it on our page. I don't even know what it is. But just look for the Majority Report on YouTube. Click and subscribe. And you know, we have clips of the show, But what we also do is have some extra content. Michael does a couple of extra special shows. They're even branded with like his silhouette.
It's true.
It's true.
It's a fantastic point.
And we're going to be doing, you know, we're going to be doing all of the debate coverage is going to be via YouTube as well as, you know, audio. But it's always fun to watch. And then once we get this election behind us, we're going to do more stuff that is like special YouTube stuff that's probably going to involve alcohol. Because, one, we had so much fun doing that during the 17-person debates and during the RNC.
It's going to be particular. A special show called Matt Gets Drunk on yeah. camera.
Well, the other thing is that one of the things I realized during the RNC is that I can actually get out of the house. So, and then...
I got to do politics, honey.
Can't believe...
Dodge.
That's not my drunk. I know. I'm not Foster.
Fucker.
What was the guy's name? Foster.
David Foster Wallace?
No, not David Foster Wallace. Jesus.
You are so...
He was like
so...
a famous drunk from the, you know, like a TV drunk.
Let's just be clear that
I can't remember.
Matt really keeps up with his core brand proposition.
Right, it's true. Jesus. All right. So all that said, subscribe to our YouTube channel. We really want to hit 100,000 subscribers in the next 2 months. That's so go and subscribe to that and just make us feel good about ourselves. I don't know. What happens, Kelly, if we hit 100,000 subscribers? What do we get? Do we get something? Foster Brooks. Thank you. Every like 45 people just I had to say it because, yeah.
If we hit 100,000, then dreams that I never thought were possible can come true. Also, maybe I don't know. Matt just kind of offered to get really drunk on camera. We could do that.
So yeah, that could be
as a reward for the viewers.
And also, when we have that problem with our feed where we get the Ken and Ken show. We got to make that a weekly situation, I think, to a certain
weekly
extent.
Weekly now? Okay.
What are we going to do, weekly or monthly?
Weekly seems
excessive.
Well,
we attempted. Weekly
does seem excessive.
We were going to try monthly, and then it went away for a while.
No, I don't want to stir a hornet's nest here, but I do like this tweet, which is, I refuse to subscribe to your YouTube channel unless every commentator is banned. Every commenter is banned.
All right. Oh, and one other point I wanted to make. We're going to do the song here is not going to be La Poupée today because this is too funny. Tim Heidecker, who, I don't know, maybe people know him from the Tim and Eric show or just 100 other shows, I guess. But for me, I was Tim and Eric, and then I had to stop watching TV because of Saul. But he came out with a song. What is the name of the song?
I Am a Cuck.
I Am a Cuck. And for some reason, I clicked on it because I wanted to.
For some reason?
I'm joking. So it's also not safe for work or really children. So if you're a child, stop listening or you're going to be punished. And if you're at work, just put your headphones on. And if your kid's around, you know, it's the end of the show if you're a freebie. And we're going to keep it on for members just because it's not La Poupée and it's pretty funny. So I Am a Cuck by Tim Heidecker.
I am gay and I voted for Obama. I am a shill for the Clinton campaign and the left-wing mainstream press. I'm a pussy who gets fucked right up the ass. I am a cop. I am a leader.
folks are all bad. But when the alt-right folks attack me, it makes me sad. I am a cuck. I am a libtard. Don't talk of Trump. Down in history and save us all from douchebags just like me. I am a cuck. I am a libtard. And a cuck has no fun. And a libtard always cries.